will just very briefly go over them, just to make the setting clear that, and to make my notations clear, right? Also to link it back to things that you have already seen today. Then I will talk about standard quantum logic, this is the syntax, language, Hilbert space semantics, the proof system, and the implication problem, and the Kripke frame semantics. After that, I will go into model logic. Yeah. Also, again, I will do then the syntax, the proof system, and the Kripke frames. So the traditional quantum logic project, well, as we've already seen, it started with the work of Birkhoff and von Neumann. Von Neumann in 32, Birkhoff and von Neumann their paper in 36. And the original aim, I could say, is to try to discover the logical structure one may hope to find in physical theories which, like quantum mechanics, do not conform to classical logic. Are the slides readable? They're okay? I don't have a very good view of them here. So based on admittedly heuristic arguments, one can reasonably expect to find a calculus of propositions which resembles classical logic, but which is not exactly the same as classical logic. So a calculus which resembles and also has operators like in the classical case, the and, the or, and the not. Yeah. So in the beginning, the quantum logic project started actually on an axiomatics, which was based on the Hilbert space structure. So that's original. Then from the 50s on, we see shift in focus in the sense that quantum logicians started looking for the abstract logical conditions without a priori starting from the Hilbert space structure to give a logical axiomatization and to prove a representation theorem. As I mean, we still have the theorems on the blackboard there, so it's very nice of Alex, and we can still see them here. So now I can also say that one of the other aims, and for instance, what Yoch and Piron in the 60s and 70s characterized as one of their aims, is to inquire on a more fundamental level about the origin of the superposition principle, and thus also to justify the use of Hilbert spaces, where I really want to stress to justify the use of them. And also, in their approaches, particularly without the appeal from the onset of the notion of probabilities. So since I come more or less from this school of quantum logic, which originated with the work of Yoch Piron, and then later on from Brussels. Since this is really more or less my background, this, I will not mention probabilities in my talk further on. Okay? Later on, after the 50s, there is the investigation of more and more general quantum structures started, and then there is a whole subject going on there. So what I will talk about now, let's first make my notations clear about the Hilbert space semantics. So we'll have a notion of state. So let H be a Hilbert space. Oh, I really can't see the screen. A state of a physical system is represented by a ray or a one-dimensional subspace. So states are ST, as denoted there. And X, Y are elements of H, which are vectors in the Hilbert space. Sigma is going to be my notation for the state space. And it's given by all the states of the Hilbert space, H. Right? Now I want to talk about logical and physical properties. So first, let's see what is a logical property. So we could say that the physical system, once I give you physical system, then physical system has physical properties, such as, for instance, some observable takes some value. Then this can be true, this can be not true. In logic, as it is traditionally done, a property or a proposition, so this is more or less known as propositions, are just sets of states. So a logical property of a quantum system is just any subset of the state space. Yeah? So S subset or equal to sigma is just any logical property. Now, not every set of factors of the Hilbert space will correspond to a logical property, but only sets that are closed under multiplication by complex scalars. So sets that are unions of one-dimensional subspaces. Now, it's very important to take into account that these indeed are logical propositions that I can work with. Now, next, quantum logicians, on the other hand, are focused more on those logical properties that can actually be tested, which means one usually concentrates only on those for which there is a measurement so that you actually can test if it's actual or not. And these I will call testable properties, or they will correspond to experimental propositions. So in the Hilbert space, the testable properties correspond to the closed linear subspaces, as we have seen also in Alex's talk before. Now, it doesn't mean that, although quantum logicians often have been working only with the testable properties, which can actually be measured, it's not the only things that make sense. There is still a way to also incorporate just the logical properties. Yeah? And how this will come up about, both of them, we will see later. Now, just to make my notation clear, so L of H is the family of closed linear subspaces, and L is the family of all subsets of sigma, which correspond to the closed linear subspaces of H. Yeah? So L, actually, is going to be the family of all the testable properties. Now, for a subspace of H, M, we denote the octocomplemented set. And instead of the perp relation that Alex used before, I will use the, yes, there is a question. Yeah. When I say a testable property will correspond to a closed linear subspace, then I mean that they are the closed linear subspaces are in one-to-one correspondence with the projectors on the Hilbert space. And these projectors you can think of as the measurements, and that's why I would call them testable in this sense. Okay? So I introduced the orthocomplemented set using the inner product notation to be zero when two vectors are orthogonal. And then I can say that when a closed linear subspace is biorthogonally closed, where I use double orthocomplementation, so my sim, so the curly symbol is my notation for the orthocomplement. And then I have the map on my curly symbol there, the orthocomplemented map on H. Let's try to see if this works. Induces a map on L of testable properties called the orthocomplement. And the notion of orthocomplement has been introduced before. So also this, I will go briefly over it. So I will talk about lattices. So Birke and von Neumann wrote this nice paper in which they motivate nicely that any logical or propositional calculus that you would start needs to be starting from an ordered structure. So actually, we need to have a partial order relation on L. Yeah, so I will work from now on with L. there, and I will take as partial order relation just the set theoretical inclusion. And then also I have the obvious order relation on L of H. And I want to note that this order relation is actually known in logic as a consequence relation. So if you heard about the consequence relation, it's actually this order relation on propositions. To obtain a lattice, we consider two operations, namely the meet and the join. The meet as the greatest lower bound and the join as the least upper bound on M and N elements of L. The join, I will denote it by this square cup. And the join is the biorthogonal closure of the union. Okay. So this is actually the subspace, if you would think in L of H, which consists of the closed linear span. So it contains all the superpositions of all the states in M and N. So in classical logic, there is the notion of disjunction. And this classical notion corresponds to the classical set theoretical union. In this case, the join is different from that. Now, there are some more conditions about which Alex already introduced them also that we need. Namely, for instance, this weak modular law and the orthocomplementation, which together we have seen as orthomodularity. Yeah? So here I stated the weak modular law again. And I think it's the same as the one which is still here on the blackboard written by Alex before. Okay. Now, here I say again, a weak modularity is actually a weaker condition than distributivity, where distributivity my join and meet I've written out there. Now, if you read Birkhoff and von Neumann's paper, then they say that distributivity is a law in classical but not quantum mechanics, because it's a logical consequence of the compatibility of observables. So if you think of this, then it's actually kind of implicit motivation why this has to fail in the quantum case, since there this compatibility of observables fails. Yeah? Distributivity is weaker, so it implies weak modularity is weaker. So we have this implication. Now, I will give an example of a Hasse diagram. And so these arrows represent the order relation. The meet, we take them, goes down, and the join goes up. So this is an example of a two-dimensional Hilbert space generated by 0 and 1, written in this way as quantum computation literature normally writes it down. And we denote the superpositions of these vectors, closed linear subspaces. So these are my states, and they are closed linear subspaces. The superpositions I write down by, for instance, plus, minus. And so all this line here, so here are the two states, and these are the superpositions, but there are many more. So for instance, you could think of the Bloch sphere with two additional points. So all this would consist or generate you the Bloch sphere, and this would be two additional points that you have to add to it, and then you obtain this lattice presentation by means of the Hasse diagram. Another one is, for instance, one in which we can see this is an abstract OML. OML standing for orthomodular lattice. This orthomodular lattice has five states. So they're denoted here by the atoms of the lattice. So I have L, R, N, F, and B. And you can check for yourself that in this way, as it is shaped, so this shape of this diagram, distributivity fails. And I've given one example here. You can check it yourself. So as kind of an overview of what I've tried to say, is that the structure of the logical properties of a given physical system is given by the power set of the state space, the power set of sigma. So sigma is my state space. It's ordered by inclusion and equipped with the standard set theoretical operations, intersection, union, and complement. Hence, this forms a Boolean algebra. So this means that if I only look at the logical properties, namely the subsets of the state space and the structure generated here, then I get the classical logic. Yes? On the other hand, if I look at the testable ones, then I get this at least orthomodular lattice, where L is inside the power set of sigma. Why I say at least, since, well, to have the exact lattice theoretical characterization of the lattice of closed linear subspaces of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, I need much more conditions than just an orthocomplementarity and a weak modularity. I need also this covering law to hold and some other conditions that were mentioned. So now, this is what I mean by a Hilbert complete axiomatization. So there exists this lattice theoretic axiomatization that is complete with respect to infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And this is Piron's theorem improved by Maillard and Soler. Yes? So this means that you can put axioms on the L structure to ensure that L is equivalent to the lattice of closed linear subspaces for some infinite dimensional H. And this is exactly this representation theorem, or what this representation theorem is about. This now is a kind of completeness result that is known in logic under the name of completeness results. So the idea is to find a kind of logical proof theoretical axiom system that matches this lattice theoretical result. And that's where the problems are going to start. So a quantum dynamic algebraic axiomatization, which is something different, is that his Hilbert complete also exists. So there is a related representation theorem with respect to infinite dimensional H, and this I will talk about in the research talk. With respect to the proof system and the syntactic axiomatization, what logicians normally do, that is Hilbert complete, it exists. But however, it's not the standard setting of orthomodular quantum logic. So what you would need to do is to get from this lattice theoretical characterization into the syntactic axiomatization. And there we'll see there are some problems. So to get a Hilbert complete axiomatization, you will need to get into a different logical setting. And that's the third hour of this tutorial is going to be about the different logic, the dynamic logical setting that you really need for that. Okay, so this representation theorem, I'm not going to go into the details of this anymore, and also not the conditions. Let's go immediately to what kind of syntax, language, and proof system have quantum logicians been working on? So what exists on the market, and why is this not Hilbert complete? Yeah, so I will introduce a language which is built up from a set of elementary formulas, P. And my language will consist of formulas phi, which are, so every P is a phi. The conjunction of two is a formula of my language, and the orthocomplement of a formula is an element of my language. So this will be called a binary conjunction or the AND, and this will be a unary operator, which I call orthocomplementation. Well, for now, I didn't introduce any meaning yet to this. So what we've seen about the Hilbert space semantics will come back later, but for now, just think about this as an abstract language without any meaning yet connected to it. So if I have this, I can introduce some notational abbreviations, namely for the join. I will say that phi join psi is given by the orthocomplement of the orthocomplement of the meet. I will introduce a bottom element, which is the meet of P and the orthocomplement of P. And I will introduce the top as the orthocomplement of the bottom, right? So the behavior of these operators is regulated by a proof theory, and the interpretation is given in a semantical model. So let's go back to the semantical model that I already presented. So the interpretation of an elementary formula is given by a closed linear subspace. So actually, this is a language to talk only about testable properties. The interpretation of the conjunction is given by the intersection. The interpretation of the orthocomplement is given by the orthocomplement of this. Now, for now, it's actually enough to give the interpretation of the basic operations in my language, although I could also say that, for instance, the interpretation of the join is given by the join of these two, capturing all the superpositions. Okay? Now, this means that every expressible well-formed formula in my language is going to be interpreted as a testable property. If I later on introduce model quantum logic, I will also have a way to talk about the logical properties, which are not testable. The logical not testable ones will also pop up later. So for now, I'm only talking about the logical testable ones. Okay? So now let's briefly go into the proof system. If we would have an implication, but in my language I didn't have any implication yet, then it's customary to give a proof system in the so-called Hilbert-style axiom and inference rule system. Without an implication, a natural deduction style becomes very interesting, because a natural deduction style proof system axiomatizes the consequence relation. The consequence relation in logic is written by means of this turnstile. So phi turnstile psi turnstile phi stands for phi is a consequence or derivable formula within quantum logic from phi. So this is just my interpretation of this. The whole thing is regulated by the proof theory, which will come up next. So I will give actually the binary logic setting, which was introduced by Goldblatt in 74. And for now, I also have to say that I will first focus on what is called minimal quantum logic, which is quantum logic without the rule stating weak modularity. Later on, we will focus on orthomodular quantum logic, and this means I will need to introduce an extra rule for that. So the proof system is rather simple. It consists of all these rules, and this is the proof system for minimal, so without orthomodularity, quantum logic. So I have identity, phi is a consequence of phi, transitivity, if psi follows from phi and gamma from psi, then gamma from phi. I have the elimination for the meet in two ways. If I have both of them follow from it. I have the introduction of the meet. I have the double negation rules, these two. I have contraposition. If psi follows from phi, then by means of the orthocomplement, I'm reversing them. And I have what logicians call ex falso, namely from the bottom element, anything follows. Now, how can you now see that this thing actually is doesn't satisfy any distributivity? So this is a weak logic from which distributivity for meet and join is not going to be provable, since join has been defined. So it's actually a trick. So if you know classical logic, then you would be able to make a distinction in the sense that if I have not phi or psi, in classical logic that psi is provable from this, in quantum logic that's not going to be the case. Now how, since y, in classical logic this comma here would stand for the meat, and this, when I have distributivity, then this immediately follows. Yeah, since the meat of these two is going to be zero, so obviously then I'm going to have psi in classical logic. Now in this case, I have to eliminate things like that, since if I have distributivity, then this follows. So this, for sure, I should not be able to prove. One of the ways how we build up this is exactly not to allow any context, just to restrict to a binary logic. So if I would have a logic in which I do allow a context, namely other formulas also to be present here, then my proof system has to be restricted in order to make sure that distributivity is not going to follow from that. Okay. So for if I want not just non-distributive logic, but really orthomodular logic, I will need to introduce a rule which is called orthomodularity, and I've written it here like that, which is an alternative formulation of the one which is written there, translated into pure logical terms. Yeah. All this lattice theoretical characterization of ortho logic are models for that logic.
No.
Without orthomodularity. So now I'm talking about orthomodular quantum logic. I add the orthomodular rule, but then it's going to be problematic to get this kind of models for it, as I will explain. So the ortho logic behaves nicely, but when we add orthomodularity, it becomes more complicated. Also, it's not so easy to say what this orthomodular law really means in terms of a simple, plausible, physical, operational motivation. So if you read Birkel and von Neumann's paper at the end, they pose one of these questions with respect to the modular law, but actually can be translated in this case also. And they ask, what is this physical, plausible motivation for it? Now, I will motivate that this, you can see that this orthomodular law is somehow connected to the failure of classical implication in the quantum case. So what is a classical implication? A classical implication is an operation between these two, which is just defined by classical negation. So I use this symbol for classical negation and this symbol for classical disjunction. So this is what is known as a material implication. Classical logic, this satisfies modus ponens. This means phi and phi implies psi, hence psi. And the deduction theorem, which is provable in classical logic. There is a proof from 1930 which says that if I do have these contexts, so where big gamma stands for a set of formulas, so in the classical case, I could allow for these contexts there, then gamma phi psi follows from it. This means that I can lift this over to this case and have an implication there. Yeah? So this holds for the classical implication. Now, the deduction theorem together with modus ponens can be stated together as what I call the implicative rule or the Galois adjunction, and this is one of the basic characterization things of what an implication in classical and intuitionistic logic is about. Namely, it's the Galois adjunct of what of the classical conjunction. So I have phi and psi follows gamma if and only if. So now I have it in two directions. Gamma implies phi. Phi implies gamma here. So indeed, look at this theorem of Skolem. If I have a lattice or a logic with a binary connective satisfying this implicative rule where the implication is the Galois adjoint of the conjunction, of the meat, then this logic is necessarily distributive. Yes? So this means that in quantum logic, obviously, this cannot hold, since from this distributivity will follow. So this is more or less what is the origin of, called the origin of the implication problem. Now, if you cannot have an implication which is the adjunct of the classical conjunction, so then what is possible in the quantum case? Can we have an implication at all? Since an implication should actually mimic what happens, what is this? Mimic the order relation on the logic between two propositions. So psi would follow from phi if and only if this implication holds. So this is minimal thing. And yes, there are connectives, implication connectives that satisfy this, that you could define. They're just not the classical material implication, but there are five other ones that in the quantum case satisfy this. Now, one of them is of particular interest to us. And this is called the Sasaki hook. Oh, no, just an example of an OML. Ah, yeah, this is an example of an orthomodal lattice, why this classical implication fails in this case. So, for instance, the one implies plus, for sure is valid. And suppose now the implication is a classical implication. This means it would be defined as orthogonal complement joined plus. So the orthogonal complement of 1 is 0, joined plus gives me always something that's always true in this logic. But this one doesn't satisfy the law of entailment, since one is not below the other one. Okay, so that's one example of why the classical implication fails, the material one. Now, which one does? It's interesting and satisfies this law of entailment. It's called the Sasaki hook. And it can be defined as this polynomial of meets and joins with the orthogonal complement here. It behaves, well, I told you there are five possible implications that I can define. This one is actually the best. I'm not giving the other ones. Why is this the best? Since it behaves locally Boolean. So if my logic would suddenly be classical, or there will be a sub logic that would be classical, then this will just become the material implication. So if I have distributivity, this is just a classical implication. In general, however, also for this one, the deduction theorem is going to fail. So of course, any implication that I can define is not going to be the adjoint of the classical conjunction. This does satisfy the modus ponens rule. And if I now fill in this polynomial of meets and joins for the Sasaki hook with modus ponens, then I will see that it corresponds completely to what I call the orthomodular rule. So in some sense, orthomodularity, as stated here in syntactical terms, really is related to this Sasaki hook, how it's stated here. So the operational physical interpretation, I didn't go into this since it's a very difficult problem. However, we know that it's connected to the Sasaki hook, but also to its dual, the Sasaki projector. And for now, I only talked about this, and that's syntactically as far as you can go. Now, I also want to give you another type of semantical structure for quantum logic. So not only the Hilbert space semantics, since there is another type of semantics which is important. So I will present relational semantics for minimal quantum logic without the orthomodal rule, following the work of Goldblatt, Discan, Dallaghiara, and others. So this semantics consists of a relational structure, sigma, which is my state space, any state space, and a relation on this. So I will call this relation for now the measurement relation, which is just a relation on sigma, which is reflexive and symmetric. Now, this measurement relation on the state space in logic is known as an accessibility relation. in quantum logic, it's known as a non-orthogonality relation or a similarity relation. The relational structure itself is known as a frame or a similarity space, or in its dual version, it's an orthoframe, an orthogonality space, a preclusivity space. So what does this mean? I will refer basically to it as a frame, since in logic, and especially modal logic, this is what is called frame. So if I have this, then I could define an orthogonality relation on the elements of sigma. So I can say S is orthogonal to T if and only if S is not related to T. Now, if sigma comes from H, then this orthogonality matches exactly the orthogonality relation on the Hilbert space given by the inner product is zero. Indeed, frames are very general generalizations of Hilbert spaces with non-orthogonality as the essential ingredient. Yes? We will call the relation on the frame a measurement relation due to the dynamic interpretation in terms of measurements that can be given to it. And that's one essential ingredient of the dynamic logic interpretation that will come up later. If I have a measurement relation which is exactly a non-orthogonality relation, I can define an orthocomplement of a set of S of sigma, similar as I did before, but now in this Kripke frame semantics. And I can also say when something is biorthogonally closed. Now, let's give some intuition for this, since I like to quote Descartes now, where he says that quantum logic is a logic of slowly changing restorable facts. And that you can see in the Kripke frame semantics. Why? So, for instance, he says that this measurement corresponds to performing, so this measurement is a relation on the state space which corresponds to changing states. So I go from S to T by performing a measurement which changes the ontic facts. Reflexivity, so this relation was reflexive and symmetric. So reflexivity means that repeating the same measurement doesn't change the state. Symmetry in this case means that there are always interior measurements that give us the original state back. Non-transitivity, indeed, I didn't impose any transitivity on this. So there are model logics in which have a Kripke frame semantics for which transitivity does make sense, but in this case it doesn't. So, and why wouldn't it be transitive? Descartes says that we can't change states very fast. For instance, while it perfectly makes sense to go from S to state T and from T to the orthocomplemented state of S, so to the orthogonal state, this doesn't make any sense. You cannot go from S immediately to the orthocomplemented state. So if transitivity would hold, this would obviously be the case, and hence it doesn't make sense. Now, let's go back to an abstract orthomodular lattice, which I have the top here, the bottom here. I have five states, L, R, N, F, and B. Now, I will show you what this measurement relation does on this structure, how you can view the measurement relation on this. And then I will give you the picture of how logicians generally present Kripke frames, since they also have a kind of diagrammatic picture presentation for it. So L is orthogonal to R. So L is red, R is here. Why are these orthogonal? Because R is under the orthocomplement of L. So this is the orthocomplement of L. L is also orthogonal to N, and N is here. Hence, I have a measurement relation from L to itself, from L to F, and from L to B, but not to the orthogonal states. Since by a measurement, I cannot go from red to blue here. Also, I can define measurement relations between the others. So I just presented some. Now, the frame presentation is the following, namely, so, as I said, I can go from L to itself, from L to B, and from L to F. Similar, from N, the middle point in the orthomodular lattice, I could only go to itself. So, a measurement on this only reaches itself. And from F, I go to R, from F I go to L, and from F I can go to itself. So this is a translation of the OML with the measurement relation. Where the only things which are important here is when, what are the states and what is orthogonal or not orthogonal. Also, for instance, my other example is when you think again of this Bloch sphere lattice, two-dimensional with H and the bottom. Then what is the lattice? What is the Kripke frame in this case? Well, the Kripke frame, I have drawn it here as a circle in which any two non-opposite points are related. So the measurement relation is just the relation here between any two non-opposite points. Yeah. So with a bit of imagination, this comes very close to the Bloch sphere, without where you have just points relating, and you avoid the middle, you avoid the center of the sphere. Now, if I want to give a semantic, so I have given you the frame. To give really a semantic, I have to go talk about valuation. And this means I will have to introduce a notion of a model. So a model is a Kripke frame with a valuation map, which goes from the logic into the power set of sigma that assigns bartonomy closed subsets to elementary formulas. So this valuation can be extended to all formulas by means of interpretation map or valuation. Actually, these are used interchangeably. So the bottom element as the empty set, the meat as the intersection between closed linear subspaces, and the orthocomplement. For the orthocomplement, I use exactly this measurement relation that of the frame that I introduced before. Namely, it's a set of states such that for all states t, there is a measurement from s to t such that t doesn't make phi true. Indeed, if I am in a state in which the orthocomplement of phi is true, this means there's no way I can go to a state that makes phi true. Yes. So once you have this valuation, a state belongs to the set of states that make phi true. I can also write it in terms of what logicians call the satisfaction relation. Now, I will have to speed up a bit about the model part. Superpositions, for instance. So you can see in this case that if phi is true in a state S, or psi is true in a state S, this will imply that the state, the join is true in the state S, but not the other way around, since this actually encodes the fact that this join is not a classical disjunction. Similar, this is not really a classical negation, since I can make the orthocomplement of phi true in a state S, but this implies that S doesn't make phi true, but the converse fails. So once I talk about valuations and interpretations, I can exactly encode what the meaning is of negation and superpositions and things like that. Soundness and completeness with respect to the Kripke model. So this is sound. Now, about completeness, we could say that all our axioms of the proof system that I presented, except for orthomodularity, are valid in this Kripke style semantics. So as shown by Goldblatt in 1984, there is no first order condition on the frame that can be imposed on this frame so that they are necessary and sufficient to validate the orthomodular law. So there is no condition on a frame that is okay for the orthomodular law. So without the orthomodularity, it's okay. But actually, we know that we need orthomodularity, since to really have a characterization in terms of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, we need even more than orthomodularity. We need all these conditions. So if you really want to have a logical axiomatization, then here things go terribly wrong. So what is a first order condition? A first order condition is a condition that can be expressed in the language of first order logic using the quantification rules of first order logic. So for instance, reflexivity is just a statement like this: for every x, y, x implies y implies that y implies x. Now, it is not possible to capture the orthomodular law or weak modularity in this first order language. So that's Yeah, that's symmetric, of course. So here I say that we actually need more conditions than only orthomodularity, and if orthomodularity already fails, then this means that we really have problems with this kind of quantum logical setting as I presented it. So how can we change this? How can we solve this problem? Namely, you have to change to a different syntax. You have to change the logic. So we actually need a dynamic model logic set. And this is what will be presented in the third hour. Now, let's briefly go over model quantum logic. I will do this very briefly, just as an introduction to Alexandra's talk tomorrow morning. So given the above mentioned measurement relation, it's actually a very close step to go to a quantum model operator. So we will present a model logic that is an extension of minimal quantum logic. Minimal quantum logic can be embedded in it such that all meaning is preserved. Hence, the following logical system is a Boolean logic extended with a quantum modality, which means that I will allow for logical and for testable properties. So the language here is just the language of classical logic with a classical negation, and in which I add a quantum box modality. So a modality here is this box 5. All the things are essentially the same, only this box I will call quantum box modality. Now, in the language, I can introduce whatever I want. So it can only make any sense if I talk about the semantics. This means the meaning of this box. So the meaning of all the classical operators are basic, but the meaning of the box is essential here. So the semantics starts from a reflexive and symmetric frame, similar as before, on which I put a valuation map, also as before. But now, since I didn't introduce any orthocomplement in this language. So the idea is to capture the orthocomplement or anything that's quantum by means of the quantum box. So box 5, the interpretation is given as in model logic by means of a set of states such that from all states T reachable from S, T satisfies phi. This is a standard interpretation for a box modality and model logic, where the box is often called necessary phi. So if you've seen any model logic, but I'm sure we'll hear more about this tomorrow. Now, in model logic, it's standard to introduce a diamond as well. So we can introduce a diamond phi as using the classical negation of box. So classical negation box not phi is the definition for the diamond. I can also give an interpretation of the diamond, but now since I use here these classical negations, this means my universal quantifier is going to become an existential quantifier. So this means there exists a state which is going to make phi true. This is a standard interpretation of the diamond modality model logic, where this is called possibly phi. So diamond phi means possibly phi. Now, I told you that the orthocomplement is going to be defined using the book. So here I will give the definition. So the orthocomplement of phi means not diamond phi or box not phi. So the interpretation means that however I go, whatever measurement I do, it will always be impossible to make phi true if I am in the orthocomplemented state. So I can give an interpretation of an orthocomplement using this box and classical negation. To show you this on a picture, so this was a picture of a cryptic frame, and I just take the same frame, and now I give an interpretation of the box. So we can see that in state L, diamond B is true. So this means there exists a state here in which B is true, namely this one. In L, it's not true that box L is true, since all the states I can go to. It's not true that L is going to be true here. L is not true here. L is not true only here. It's true, but it needs to be for all states drawing from this one. In N, I can see that box N is true, since however I can go from N, I always satisfy N. So box N is true. This one, in L, box diamond L is true, since however I can go, there exists always a relation that makes L true. So if I go here, there's always one which goes back here, and that makes L true. Similar for F. I will tell you something about the impact of the classical negation in this case. As I said before, this means that not every formula in monoquantum logic will be interpreted as a testable one. It can be logically non-testable. Indeed, not all the formulas are going to be quantum testable. So a logical property was an arbitrary set of states. Not all arbitrary sets of states are going to be bi-orthogonally closed. So there is a theorem that I can prove that if the interpretation is quantum testable, then it's going to be equivalent to some formula involving a box or the orthocomplement. So quantum testably means that in my language, this is going to make use of my quantum measurement relation. And the interpretation which uses the quantum measurement relation are all these box, diamond box, the orthocomplement of or double orthocomplement. There is a proof theory for this as well. And the proof theory, I'm not going into any details, but the proof theory is actually the one which has been called after Brouwer, and which is the standard minimal model logic with two rules, one which translates reflexivity and the other which translates symmetry, since these were the two frame conditions. So I have two rules in the logic which corresponds to these two frame conditions. Now, this logic gives us the basis of the embedding of minimal quantum logic into the Brouwer logic P, since you can see that the semantical structure is actually the same. So everything that I can prove in one, I can also prove in the other, but I can do even more. So this model quantum logic, I can express all the testable properties in it, since I have this box and I can capture the orthocomplement. But I can express actually more. So this logic has more expressive power than quantum logic has. Why? Since besides all the testable ones, I also have the logical properties. So for all the testable properties captured by minimal quantum logic can also be expressed here. It captures more, since for every not necessarily testable property, there exists a box that has a quantum testable property in its meaning. In particular, the quantum testable property expressed by box not P, for instance, is not even expressible in minimal quantum logic. But it is expressible in this one. So due to this negation, I can now take, I can talk, even express this negation in this logic, and then take the quantum property of this, which will give me a testable property, which I can otherwise not even express in the language of minimal quantum logic. So this logic is actually more expressible. Okay, I think the time is up, so I will stop here. And then tomorrow, Alexandru can go on about more details about model, epistemic, and especially dynamic logic, and which kinds of frames that we need for dynamic logic, since that will be necessary to do dynamic quantum logic in the third hour. Are there questions? Oh, that's a hard question, since first about the complexity issues, I didn't really look at them. the octal logic for sure is decidable. For the octal modular logic, there are problems with decidability and with the final model property, which is connected to that, which is in the paper of Goldblatt. Yeah. But then, for us, it's much more important to look, for instance, at this propositional dynamic logic that has been used in computer science. And there, the complexity class has been studied. And then to look at the quantum case for that. But that would be next work. So. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So would there be any sense to some kind of logic for testing properties without relation to your test possible operating test?
I guess so, but I haven't looked at that. I don't know. You know, maybe more. I guess. I didn't look at that. I didn't restrict the operators.
I mean, I'm sorry, less than reasonable.
I know it's not going to be standard PDF. No, no, no. It's going to be very, it's going to be kind of frame PDL. Dynamic frame in which you're going to have lots of conditions. For instance, you're going to need this to express this orthomodular law in some sense. So you need some kind of conditions that are going to express that. You need a condition for reflexivity, for symmetry, but you do not want transitivity. So we are going to have 10 conditions. Yeah, they're going to get difficult, but still, I mean, for instance, we're not going to use the star operation there. So that's going to make it easier than PDL with star. So, but that we'll see later. So no more questions? Thank you. Thank you.